She's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature.
Welcome to Nature Bets Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.fm. This August 6th, 2019 edition, episode 129 of Nature Bets Last, comes to you live from Raikino Island in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and also from Westchester County, New York, in the United States. This is Kevin Hester, and I'm again joined today by my co-host, Professor Guy McPherson. Today's show includes a conversation with Dr. Andrew Glickson, who's been a previous guest on the show in February 2018. Over to you, Guy.
I'm doing well, Kevin. Thank you very much. I'd like to point out that today marks the five-year anniversary to this day on the Progressive Radio Network. This will be my first conversation with renowned geologist Dr. Glickson, and I'm very much looking forward to it. We will be taking your toll-free calls today. Please call us with your questions and comments after we spend a bit of time with our guest. We are most easily reached with a toll-free telephone call to 888-874-4888. Kevin, will you introduce our guest?
Dr. Andrew Glickson is a geologist living in Australia. He is an earth scientist and paleoclimatologist, currently serving as visiting fellow at the Australian He's the author of dozens of articles and 10 books, notably including his 2015 masterpiece, Climate, Fire, and Human Evolution, The Deep Time Dimensions of the Anthropocene. Welcome back, Dr. Glickson, to Nature Bets Last on the Progressive Radio Network.
Yes, it's good to talk to you, Kevin. How are you?
I'm very well, sir. Thank you very much for giving us your valuable time yet again. The first place I'd like to start, if possible, is I'd like you to give us an overview of your recent article published in Global Research titled Beyond Climate Tipping Points, Greenhouse Gas Levels Exceed the Stability Limit of the Greenhouse and Antarctic Ice Sheets. Could you give us an overview of that, please?
Yeah, thank you. Well, the level of combined greenhouse gases, which is defined as carbon dioxide equivalent, has now reached, when it's all combined, it's now reached more than 500 parts per million. Now, this intersects the stability fields of the large ice sheets, both Greenland and Antarctic, which means once this limit or threshold is intersected, it's hard to see a way back. There is a lag effect of the breakdown and melting of the large ice sheet, but what it signifies is the fundamental transition of the climate state, the shifting climate state of the Earth, and the rest follows because the poles, the large ice sheets, they act like thermostats of the Earth. Once the thermostats start to weaken and eventually go, a number of things happen. The ice melts into the oceans, raising up ocean levels, and sea level is now committed to rise by many meters. The other thing is the cold fronts emanating from the Arctic and from Antarctic but particularly from the Arctic, the breakthrough what used to be the barrier between the polar regions and the more temperate regions, and you get the penetration of a freezing front, such as has just happened last year in Northern Europe and in North America. So the existing or the previous climate state is breaking down. You get heat waves from the tropics. You get sea level rise. You get storminess, which comes from the contrast between the warming continents and the cooling oceans, or cooling parts of the oceans, and so on.
As part of the research as I was doing for the show, I read that article that you sent me that was published on Springer, and the title was North Atlantic and Sub-Antarctic Ocean Temperatures, Possible Onset of a Transient State or Cooling Stage. And in that article, you refer to the effects that melt may have on the AMOC, or the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. Could you go into that briefly, please?
Well, yes, the AMOC is the flow of the North Atlantic thermal current, which originally emanates from the tropics, from the Gulf of Mexico. This weakens and recedes, and the cold water region, which you can see on the temperature maps, expand. At this stage, it's not very large, but it's significant. So that's one thing which happens. The other thing is the weakening of the boundary, which I just mentioned now, between the Arctic and between the temperate zones of Europe and of North America. So that's the other article which was published, and between the two of them, they question the linear climate projections of the IPCC. When you look at the IPCC projection, they are linear and smooth. Well, nothing smooth like this happens in nature. In most cases, you get strong perturbations. There are analogies with events which happened in the past when the Earth was about 1 degree or so warmer. This resulted in extensive melting of ice sheets and resulted in events such as the Laurentian melt 8,300 years ago, and in the Younger Dryas 11,700 to 12,500 years ago.
I would love to be a fly on the wall while you were discussing this issue with your colleague at the Australian National University, Joelle Geergis. I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name right or not, but I read an article that she wrote recently on themonthly.com, and she's a contributor to the IPCC, but in the article, she mentioned that there's only been 1 degree C of temperature increase, and she's using 1850 to 1900 as a baseline. I find it really irresponsible to use such late baselines, and that's one of the reasons why climate sensitivity has been underestimated, and why the situation is always worse than we think, because of this shifting of the use of the baseline. How does your contact with Ms. Geergis go?
Oh, I have sent her my articles. We did not have a discussion yet, but we will. The thing is, she is talking about the average land ocean temperature. On the land itself, a temperature of reason on average 1.5. That's according to the Berkeley Institute. And in the poles, as you know, they've risen 2.3 and higher. So it depends which part of the Earth you're looking at. Averages can be, well, they smooth out the differences, and they don't tell the whole story. But she is right. I mean, her article in the Monthly is very good, and she also mentions the change in sensitivity, climate sensitivity, which is now considered to be higher than 3 degrees, which was the case. That's 3 degrees for doubling of the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Now it's considered to be higher. But it was always a question about climate sensitivity, exactly how high it is. And the Earth doesn't operate, or the climate doesn't operate as a precise clock. you can have averages which smooth out the contrast between what is happening. When you look at temperature maps of the Earth, like those produced by NASA, you don't see any uniform picture. You see a highly variable picture, extreme warming in the poles, and somewhat lesser polling in other regions.
Yes, I think that the issue of climate sensitivity is crucial to this whole story, and it's been underestimated to a large degree. I have a blog post on my website about climate sensitivity, and in it I have a presentation from David Wasdell. Are you aware of his work?
Oh, yes, vaguely, yes. Climate sensitivity is an average. It's 3 plus minus 1.5. And again, it varies in different regions of the Earth. We can average things until they become meaningless. So you have to look at what's actually happening on the Earth. And that's a problem with the IPCC future climate projections. Once again, there is a linear rise to, well, as high or higher than 4 degrees. There is not such thing. Different zone, different climate zones in the Earth warm to different extents, and you have to look at what's happening on the ground.
Yeah, I think the discussion about linear and non-linear change is crucial to the whole debate. I'm sure you're aware of the wonderful work of Dr. Albert Bartlett and his presentations on the exponential function. I often quote his expression, quote, "The greatest shortcoming of the human race is our inability to understand the exponential function."
Yeah, okay. Well, I follow James Hansen and his very large group of climate and paleoclimate scientists. When you look at the paper of 2016, you will see the projection for at least the rest of the century and further includes very sharp dips in temperature for periods of several decades. That's his, we call it stadial, which means the cooling following warming as a result of the flow of ice melt water from the ice sheets. This happened right through the quaternary history of the Earth, the last 800,000 years recorded in the ice cores, that every time temperatures have reached a maximum during interglacials, you had strong cooling as a result of a flow of ice melt, cold ice melt water into the oceans.
Guy, would you like? You have a few questions you'd like to follow up with?
Yes, I would. Thank you very much. First, I guess the obvious question, will you take a minute to compare the ongoing 6 mass extinction to some of the previous 5 mass extinctions with respect to the rapidity of change, for example?
You asking me, Guy?
Yes, I am. Sorry, I didn't make that clear, Dr. Glickson.
Well, it's nice talking to you, Guy, after all the correspondence we had in the past.
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Yes, no, the event now is unique in terms of the current rise or abrupt rise of temperatures occurs above an interglacial, which means apart from the normal fluctuations of glacial-interglacial, which are about 5 degrees or so, now we're having another degree or degree and a half. And in fact, when you look at the rise in carbon dioxide to 500 parts per million equivalent, in fact, it's more, it's 560 if you include the carbofluorides. If you take a climate sensitivity of even 3, which is low, the average, per doubling of carbon dioxide, we are now committed to 3 degrees. So 3 degrees above an interglacial, at least in the quaternary, is totally unusual, totally unique, and the rate at which it's happening over just, well, basically half a century is from about 1975, I'd say, the temperature shot up, to the present, the rate is closest to the rate of the climate disruption caused by an asteroid impact. It's a higher rate than at the end of glacials, it's a higher rate which I can see in the geological record anywhere. This is an extreme event. It's not climate change. It's extreme climate disruption. And the rate is, and I have published it actually. I'm sure you have seen these papers. The rate causes a result in that species cannot adapt. The species can adapt very well, and they have right through the history of the Earth adapt to very major changes, as long as they occur over periods of thousands, tens of thousands and longer. But when the change comes as abruptly as with asteroid impact or with what's happening now, well, all hell breaks loose, as you know.
You know, when I don't hear many other climate scientists speaking with the straightforward language that you're using today. I very much appreciate your language, but you mentioned James Hansen, and he actually said one of my recent statements was crazy. That's a direct quote. And I don't hear him sounding the alarm the way I hear you indicating that this is an alarming situation. And it's not just James Hansen, obviously. There's a whole lot of other climate scientists. So to what do you attribute this difference in your willingness to speak out and the more conventional approach, which is to, well, to use a term that James Hansen came up with himself in a 2007 paper, employ scientific reticence? What's the difference? What's going on here?
Right. The scientific reticence is not his. It's that of many other climate scientists. I can send you quotations, and if you like, I will, from James Hansen, which express an alarm as high as that of anyone, certainly as high as mine. James Hansen and his group of some almost 20 climate scientists have observed what is happening now, almost 30 years ago. His articles contain references to the Earth changing and changing very rapidly from one state to the other. And when I send them to you, I cannot quote them. There's no time to quote them right here and now. He is what the denialists would call an alarmist and more than that. So I suggest have a look at some of the things which he says. Plus, it's not only the alarm which he writes. His papers and even books contain the most detailed description of what is happening now, what's happening over the last, at least the last few hundred years. And to me, some of the best projections. He projects 5 meters sea level rise this century. Well, it might or might not happen, but this is a much higher projection than that of almost any other scientist.
Yes, I understand perfectly well, and I was referring to his 2007 paper when he described scientific reticence on behalf of other scientists, and he has been willing to step out and make projections and make statements that are beyond what most climate scientists are willing to do.
Yes.
And, that makes him exceptional, and I would say that you're going as far or farther than he has been going recently. And so what I guess I'm wondering about the culture, the scientific academic culture there in Australia, is it different? James Hansen at some level is protected by him being the long-term authority and by his position as a result. But it seems that there's not very many people who are sounding the alarm, despite the fact that the United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases pointed out in 1990 that we're going to trigger the kinds of events we're seeing today with as little as a 1 degree C temperature rise. And we're well beyond that, as you pointed out. And yet so many other climate scientists are having a hard time keeping up with the kind of forceful language that you are using. So I guess I'm looking for a rationale behind your strong language, or maybe I'm just looking for a rationale why other people are not employing such language.
Well, I can obviously say myself. The rationale is in my papers, and you will appreciate probably not time to give too much detail. But the rationale is in that the boundaries are breaking. That's between the poles. See, the poles are the keys. If the poles melt, as they are doing now, then the rest, it affects the rest of the Earth, which I'm sure you fully appreciate. Plus the temperatures in the tropics, which are rising. But you're asking me now to refer to other climate scientists. Well, it's a matter of degree. They are all worried, but they express their concern in different ways. Mostly, they will have the peer review papers, which give great detail and quite reliable, credible detail about what is actually happening in the land and the oceans. But when it comes to public pronouncements, that's different. People have jobs. People have lost their jobs. People don't want to scare their families and people right around them because everybody wants to live another day. So there is a strong psychological effect for climate scientists. Perhaps you can compare it to oncologists. An oncologist does not want to keep on telling the patient and the family that they're going to die soon. Oncologists don't want to do it, yet they have to be honest at the same time, and when they're asked, give some information, which is the correct, detailed scientific information. Well, climate scientists are caught in between these two positions. And depends on the individual. Some will express greater alarm, and some will be what you call moderate, and other ones will just be very quiet. I'm sure you know all of that.
Yes, of course. Okay, I want to change topics here a little bit. And first, if you could bear with me while I ask a very long question, or rather provide extensive information so that I can ask the question. And this is not for you, because it's based on an article you wrote, but it's instead for our listeners. On September 28th, 2018, you wrote an essay titled Climate Projections, A World on Borrowed Time. You finished that essay with a quote from Camus' 1942 book, The Myth of Sisyphus. Here's the quote. Having pushed a boulder up the mountain all day, turning toward the setting sun, we must consider Sisyphus happy. And you precede that final sentence of your essay with a few words about existential philosophy, writing, existentialist philosophy offers a perspective into and a way of coping with what otherwise defies rational contemplation. Going through their black night of the soul, members of the species may be rewarded by the emergence of a conscious dignity devoid of illusion, grateful for the glimpse into nature for a fleeting moment. Can you please expand on that a little bit? Can you comment on that fleeting moment, on the happiness of Sisyphus?
Yeah, well, thank you for this question. That's a deep personal and philosophical question, obviously, which I'm sure that you and others have been going through. Well, my background is in deep time and air science, and I've arrived at the paleoclimate science through the study of the great mass extinctions of species. Now, mass extinctions occur within a blip of an eye, as you know. What is happening now, I think I'm afraid has been underestimated. It's also happening within a blip of an eye. Not second or minutes, but really a few decades. And the reason that I look at it this way is that the rate, again, I come back to the rate and scale of what is now happening, the degree of forcing, rise of temperature, it's not 1 degree. It's the 2.3 degrees of the melting ice sheets is a very relevant figure. What's happening now is happening, I think, faster than most climate scientists would have expected or anticipated. So we live at the moment, I mean, my personal philosophical position is to live in the moment, because as soon as I think about the future, well, I don't want, it's unthinkable to me. That's become personal by looking at the climate, and before that, looking at extinctions over the last, 40, 50 years. So the philosophy is to live for the moment, but as soon as you start thinking about what's happening actually in terms of time, you are trying to look at the unthinkable. So I don't know whether this answers your question. It's objective, natural, but it's also personal. We have to be able to cope with our knowledge, like you. I'm sure you have to cope with your knowledge. And of course,
yes,
expressions which you have come through are powerful. We express ourselves somewhat differently, but they're both powerful and they're both expressed in view of events which, again, I come to the word unthinkable.
Yeah, that's a wonderful response. Thank you very much. And you have gone beyond what so many people are willing to do, which is to delve into your personal response. Now, I want to go down that path a little further. A PhD means Doctor of Philosophy. So the obvious question, given that we brought up philosophy, is how has philosophy influenced your work? What's the nexus for you, the intersection between science, the natural science that you have become so well known for, and philosophy, both personal and at a larger scale?
Yeah, thank you for asking. Of course, Doctor of Philosophy is just a formal academic term. I did study geology. Now, you're asking me about the philosophy of the existential threat that we are living under. Well, it's not the first one. Of course, for many years, in my younger years, it was and still is the nuclear threat, which is not getting any less. So living under the shadow of the nuclear mushroom has a lot of parallels with what's happening now. With the exception that the nuclear can happen within, well, minutes, maybe hours, where the climate is now progressing. The nuclear is latent, it's potential. It's all there in the missiles and the submarines, and we can hardly see it because it's once it's released, well, it's released. But with the climate, we can see the process. We can see the consequences of the process in so many parts of the Earth. Of course, as you know, whether it's the Caribbean or whether it's the Southwest Pacific Islands, they are now subject to regular cyclones and typhoons, which are killing. The World Health Organization estimated it that 250,000 people have already died as a result of these disasters, extreme weather events and so on. But I get a little bit lost. The question you ask me is about philosophy or my philosophy. I wonder if you can clarify the question.
Yeah, let me back up a little bit. We talked about Camus earlier. Most people called him an existential philosopher, although he didn't like to be categorized with respect to his philosophy or anything else. He preferred to be called a writer rather than a philosopher, and he bristled at the notion of being called an existentialist. But, and I feel pretty much the same way. I'm sometimes called an existentialist and sometimes called a philosopher. I think I'm more a writer and so on. And I'm wondering if you can go down that personal path with us. Would you call yourself a philosopher? If so, would you call yourself an existential philosopher? If not, is it because you don't like to be labeled? Would other people refer to you in these terms as an existentialist, for example?
Well, I'm an existentialist only to the extent that I try to live to the most in the moment rather than let my mind wander to the past and the future. Other than that, of course, there are different varieties of existentialism. There is political, there is personal, and I've read Camus. I like to add that it's the most difficult thing to point this enormous, infinite danger which we are now facing to other people. You don't want to go and tell people that they're going to die. You certainly don't want to do that, and certainly not to young people. And I avoid it like the plague. I try and use, well, basically scientific language, trying to point out to the changes in the climate and so on, with the hope that people will understand what's happening and what are the consequences, understand for themselves. I don't want to be like that fellow going down the street and saying the end is near. I try and avoid it like the plague, because it goes against, against life in the present, against hope. So what I do is, when I talk in lectures and so on, I try and point out to the actual physical processes. If people are intelligent, and many of course are, they will look through the evidence and understand. If they are less than intelligent, or if they don't want to know, well, I don't think there's very much which can be done.
Well, I certainly agree with that. Just last month, we interviewed Rory Verratto, a scholar of existential philosophy and also a scholar of climate science. He, like many other scholars, especially younger ones, seems to be following in your footsteps with respect to connecting the large-scale phenomena, including climate change, for example, with their personal lives, with, as you say, living in the moment. So what words of wisdom do you have for people, smart people like Rory Verratto, who are willing to stare reality in the face and recognizing that that reality is truly horrendous?
What word do I have to say to them? Well, we are on the same page. All I can say to them is what I was saying before for myself. In fact, even well before the climate and nuclear scares, life has always been in the moment. Think about World War II and the concentration camps. Think about what people had to face, life being short and brutish and brutal, right through history, the Middle Ages. We, people like us in the Western world, are living in a bubble, in a relatively safe and luxurious bubble, even though I don't think it's really safe. But we live in some sort of a futuristic world where all electronic devices and everything else, like food and so on, are available to us for the moment. So what we're talking about is really the human condition, not as it is this moment or second, but it has been right through the ages. People lived short lives. I think the average life was not all that much more than 30 or 40. What do I have to say to these people? Well, when I meet them, we are on the same page, but everyone responds in his own personal way. When you have a young family, you are preoccupied 99% with putting food on the table and securing your the people around you. When you are young, many young people now march on the street with the existential revolution or other. When you are older, like me, you try and warn people. I'm not completely, when I express myself, I don't express myself completely on the side of the danger. I always point out to potential avenues, the only potential, such as carbon dioxide drawdown. If the world's invested or directed its enormous resources which go into, for example, defense in the military, if they directed these trillions of dollars into a whole range of technologies for carbon dioxide drawdown, maybe there would have been a chance. I'm not sure about it. No one can be sure. But at least they would have tried. Guess what? As you know, they're not trying.
Yes, I did pick up on
look,
that.
I would like to interject at this point, if I could, because the way we've gone down the road about the psychological consequences of dealing with the knowledge that we have is that when we spoke before, Andrew, we talked about the poetry that you wrote. And I think, you know, I have my antidote to despair is I volunteer at a not-for-profit nursery on a rewilding project. We propagate native trees for rewilding. And that's one of the things that I do to take my mind away from the existential crisis that we're facing and to try and do something constructive and that's good for me and good for the natural world. So, Andrew, I'd really love it if you'd tell our listeners where we could find the poetry that you've written and the link between that and your scientific experience and knowledge, please.
Yeah, well, thank you for asking that. I can certainly send you and send Guy in my poetry books. This will be very good. Now, you're asking me where is the connection. Well, obviously, looking at the existential threats, first the nuclear, now the climate, I had to express the way I feel about it. And rather than go and scream in the street, which I'm not very inclined to do, I write poetry, and the poetry, some of the poems express my anguish in this result, in this respect.
Wonderful. I think it's a spectacularly good way for people to deal with the emotional roller coaster. If you send that to me, I'll include it in my blog post, the information about access to your poetry, I'll include it in my blog post so that everyone who's listening to this can trace it back and find that work. Thank you very much. Could we just get back to the Arctic for a moment, please? At the moment, there is a fire burning in Siberia that has so far burnt 4.3 million hectares of forests. That's an area larger than the size of Denmark. Since the beginning of the year, in total, 13.1 million hectares has burnt. And all of this is happening up around the Arctic Circle. And a lot of the soot will be landing on the ice in the Arctic, lowering the albedo. Scripps Institution Oceanography posted a new paper on July the 22nd, 2019, and it was titled, "Loss of Arctic's Reflective Sea Ice Will Advance Global Warming by 25 Years." Could you tell us what you think, please, about the coming BOE, or Blue Ocean event, in the Arctic, and what you think about how dangerous is the albedo feedback loop, please?
Yeah, the albedo flip is the essential process which occurs on the ice sheets and sea ice. So, of course, as you know, even a few millimeters of water on the surface of the ice, and that's whether it's continental or oceanic ice, will absorb infrared. The infrared will melt a tiny bit of ice, and the water will once again absorb infrared and melt more ice. This is a very rapid process. In fact, that's the reason for some of the major climate flips which occurred in the past, the albedo flip. And in the past, as you probably know, the Younger Dryas, which is a huge event, it lasted for more than 1,000 years, between 11,700 and 12,500. It started in the north, in the Arctic, in Greenland. It started within a few days. Unbelievable. Within a few days, the temperature went down and froze. This is the opposite of the albedo flip, the opposite effect of the albedo flip. For just as much as the ice can melt within a short time, it can also freeze within a very short time as the reflection starts. So what I'm pointing at is that the key, as quite a few people say now, the keys are on the ice sheets and the rest follows in other climate zones. So you're asking me about the fires. Well, yes, of course. The fossil fuel, or the fuel rather, in the Tanga, in the tundra in Siberia, it's very important. But far more important are the methane deposits in the Arctic. There are more than there are many billions of tons of methane which are already bubbling, already released into the air and into the water. And methane already constitutes 2% of the greenhouse gases. And in terms of its radiative forcing, you have to multiply it by anywhere between 25 and 100 to get the greenhouse effect. So the Arctic is the key, and the tundra fires coming due to warming of the of Siberia. Yes, it's extremely serious.
Yeah, well, that brings me back to an issue. I've read a lot from both yourself and Professor McPherson about the work of two Russian scientists, Dr. Natalia Shakova and Igor Semilitov, who are field researchers in the Arctic. They were both based at the University of Fairbanks in Alaska. And they've been talking about the potential for a huge methane release. Now we see the tundra burning and all of that methane being released. But in a recent article on climatecrocs.com, Dr. Michael Mann described Natalia Shakova and Igor Semilitov as alarmists. Surely we should be keeping the precautionary principle and being concerned about what these field researchers have found.
Alarmist? Well, we are all alarmist. I think the three of us talking here, that's a pejorative term aimed towards scientists who are trying to present the evidence. Now, of course, the evidence might be accurate, might be less accurate, in some instances not accurate. But what scientists, I see the duty of scientists is in presenting the evidence the best they can. You can say James Hansen is an alarmist. He has been called it. Now, Shakova, it's interesting. They have actually measured methane release hotspots in the Arctic Sea, north of Siberia. There is no reason to suspect that the measurements are not correct. But
I think what that amounts to is that the prognosis is so dire that no one wants to even think about it.
This is the psychological effect of some people. And whoever wanted to attend some conferences in the West and could not and so on. The question is, are her data reliable and accurate or not? I'm not aware that the data have been questioned. It's Shakova who have been questioned. And it comes back to the, cultural and political divide between the West and between the East. But methane, you don't even have to look at what Shakova has done. When you look at at NASA and when you look at the NASA pages, methane has risen to 1,890 parts per billion, which is almost 2%, 2%. Of methane in the atmosphere. This is enormously high. This is from early in the 19th century. It was only a couple of hundred parts per billion. Well, if this is not alarming, I don't know what is alarming.
I think the relevant phrase here might be shoot the messenger. That's what comes to mind for me anyway. I have a follow-up question about the ice. Even the president of Finland, about 2 years ago, in a joint press conference with President Trump in the Oval Office, even the president of Finland said, if we lose the Arctic, we lose the globe. That is reality. And I assume that he was talking about losing the Arctic ice and therefore losing habitat for human animals on the planet. So it seems that a politician knows, but some scientists are reluctant to go that far. Can you maybe comment on that and the pushback or the feedback you get when you're willing to sound the alarm in the name of the precautionary principle?
Yes, that's thank you. To be careful can be a two-edged word, sword. Scientists can be careful in the direction of trying to appear objective, trying to maintain the job, trying to mellow the language, trying to smooth the edges. Or they can be careful on the side of protecting human life on Earth. These are very different types of being careful, and the only answer will be to stick to the evidence. I try, if I can at all, not to be either too pessimistic or too optimistic. I try and shy away from these emotions. I try and look back and back and back again at the evidence. And it's the evidence which tells, at least, certainly tells me, but I'm sure it now tells increasing number of people. The evidence is, to say it's shocking is probably an understatement.
I couldn't agree more with that assessment, that the evidence is overwhelming and certainly on the rise. In light of that, as a scientist, as somebody who has spent a lot of time as a scholar looking at extinction events, you must be asked routinely for solutions, as I am. I'm constantly asked for solutions to solve the ongoing sixth mass extinction, as well as the ongoing abrupt version of climate change. And I'd love to have something to say to the people who ask me for the solutions. Have you got any advice for me and maybe for the rest of us who face that situation?
So you like to ask about solutions. The level of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, which I mentioned before, I think it's actually 560 and more parts per million, is already generating amplifying feedbacks from land and ocean, which means even if they stopped emitting carbon tomorrow, which I doubt, that level in the atmosphere, greenhouse, is going to continue to activate sources of carbon on Earth. For example, methane is already bubbling, and I don't know what can stop it. So the only thing I can think about, and that's the only possibility I can think about, is carbon dioxide drawdown, because there are a number of techniques now, including streaming of air through basalts, which will produce calcium carbonate, including seaweed kelp, which absorbs carbon dioxide, and numerous other sodium trees, and I'm sure you know the list. It's a long list. However, all of it has only happened either in the laboratory or on a small scale, which means if the human race, Homo sapiens so-called, decided to save life as it is on the planet, I'm not talking about microbial life and about deep sea events, but I'm talking about advanced life. If we decided to do something to cool the earth by drawing down greenhouse gases, would be, to me, the primary method. And the resources for that, actually, James Hansen did estimate the resources. I think it was $300 per ton of carbon dioxide. I'm not sure. It depends on the methodology. But if human race decided to do something meaningful about the issue, they could have, for something of the order of the military budget worldwide, which is, oh, I think it's 2 or 3 trillion per year from every side, try and invest it in trying to stabilize or cool the atmosphere. Now, I'm not saying that it's a very promising method. In fact, there are huge problems associated with it, and it might or might not succeed. But I just cannot think about another way.
Well, I'm similarly skeptical of any approaches beyond carbon capture, and I don't see much effort being taken in that direction. So, given that, given the rate of ongoing environmental change right now, given that there doesn't seem to be any political interest in anything resembling a solution, what do we do? What do you and I do? And specifically, I want to make this personal again. And I know as a scholar that becomes uncomfortable. What, again, is the role of philosophy in our work? It used to be that philosophy and science were one and the same when we go back 2,000 years. And I would say that a gradual crumbling turned into, with the establishment of the National Science Foundation post-World War II, turned into a complete separation of the two, philosophy and science. So from your perspective, where are we at? What is the role of philosophy? How do we live with this existential threat? You mentioned nuclear winter. Is that going to fix anything? Is that going to solve abrupt runaway climate change? Is that going to point us in the right direction? I have 10,000 questions, and I'm trying to boil it down to only 50 or so that you might be able to answer in the next few minutes.
Well, it's not as if I have the answers, but nuclear winter is another kind of extreme climate change, except it will completely shield and freeze large parts of the Earth, plus the radioactivity. So I cannot see anything positive. By the time the aerosols settle down, you're still stuck with climate change. You're still stuck with the carbon dioxide greenhouse gases. I have about 3 years ago, I think 2 or 3 years ago, published a book called Plutocene, The Post-Anthropocene Earth, which part of it has to do with the climate, part of it has to do with the nuclear issue. Now, I'll be very pleased to send you a PDF of this book. I ran out of hard copies, but I send you a PDF. And this is, it's not a forecast, of course. It's not any precise forecast. But it documents the major elements of what the Earth would go through as this process continues. So you're asking me, how do we live? Is this what you ask? How do people like us continue to live?
Yes, how do we live? And especially given that it seems nobody is interested in applying large-scale solutions that might mitigate for our bad behavior so far.
Yeah, fair enough. Thank you. To me, all I can do is try and answer to my conscience. Even though it's painful, there are penalties attached in terms of people's attitude around me, professional work, risks of antagonizing people, and all that. To be a messenger of doom and gloom is a horrible punishment. So I try and use, as I said before, purely as a language, with the hope that those people who understand might or might not do something about it. This way, I try to answer to my own conscience, and, well, that's basically what it is. I don't have any illusions whatsoever that anything I do will have an effect, but I just have to express my understanding based on the science of what is now happening.
I would say this is completely consistent with Camus' version of Sisyphus. So I don't think it's a bad way to go at all. And there's little doubt that the myth of Sisyphus contributed to Camus being awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature. So I think you're in good company there.
Well, I actually like to ask you now, in return, well, how do you cope? How do you feel? How do you see your life, our lives in the present, in view of the existential threat that we are facing, or even relation with people around you?
Homer pointed out in the Iliad, which he wrote some 2,800 years ago, any moment might be your last. And that's how I try to live. As if any moment will be my last, fully aware that almost certainly any moment will not be my last. And so there's this balancing act between continuing to floss and brush my teeth and living with extreme urgency. And so for me, that's been probably the most difficult task that I've taken on in my life. And I've been trying to do it since I was in my early 30s. And that's a long time now. And It's difficult to give other people that advice because we are embedded within a culture that adheres to the infinite growth paradigm, that we can just keep this whole set of living arrangements going forever. And not only that, but we can constantly improve our conditions based on technology. So for me, it's a real battle. I'm trying to live it to the greatest extent I can in the moment, And yet I know it's not my last moment unless an asteroid hit. And then I keep in mind that we are the asteroid that hit with respect to warming the planet, with respect to changing the environment. So, like with most people, I am contained with a multitude of different emotions and therefore different actions in response to this great existential threat we face. And I would argue many existential threats. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Andrew Glickson. We have run out of time. It's been wonderful talking with you today. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to talk with a scholar who has an understanding of deep time and its relevance to how we live today. So thank you very much.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. I mean, I just have no choice. I never thought I had a choice when it comes to an issue of this nature. And treating people as if it's the first time I meet them and the last time I meet them, first and last, is one of my coping mechanisms. Because I no longer believe in the future, the past or the future. I believe, if I do believe, it's just in the moment. Life at the moment is a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful gift we have from nature.
Hey, thank you so much, Andrew, for your time. It's been wonderful speaking with you. I'm sorry we're going to have to wrap this interview now. Thanks to all our contributors and listeners today, as well as AfroZen for our theme music. You can catch NBL on PRN on the first Tuesday afternoon of the month, Eastern Time. Our next episode airs on September the 3rd, 2019. Thank you very much, Andrew. I'll be in touch with you via email. I'll hand it over to the studio now.
Mother Nature, she's gonna get